from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Sydney Kohara, in for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, we'll find out about new research into sleep apnea, a disorder characterized by abnormal pauses in breathing during sleep. A study out this week from UCSF and the California Pacific Medical Center finds that people who suffer from sleep apnea may also be at increased risk of developing dementia. We'll discuss the new report and treatment options for sleep apnea, which affects an estimated 12 million Americans. That's coming up on Forum right after this. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Sydney Kohara, in today for Michael Krasny. We begin this morning with a study that is shedding new light on sleep apnea. It's a disorder where a person stops breathing for a brief period while they sleep. Researchers from UCSF and the California Pacific Medical Center studied almost 300 women and found those with sleep apnea were about twice as likely to develop dementia during the next 5 years. My guest this hour will talk about how this research might change the treatment for sleep disorders. Katie Stone is an epidemiologist at the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute and co-author of that study on sleep apnea. Dr. Kushida is neurologist and sleep specialist, professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at Stanford University. He is also the medical director of the Stanford Sleep Medicine Center. And Edward Grandy is executive director of the American Sleep Apnea Association. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to all of you. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Katie, let's start with you. When we talk about sleep apnea, describe sleep apnea.
Okay. Well, sleep apnea involves the collapsing of the throat or the constricting of the throat during sleep, which actually causes an individual to stop breathing. And what happens at the same time is that the blood oxygen levels drop, and generally the individual will wake up. So sleep apnea causes two things that we think might have an impact on health, one being sleep fragmentation, because they're waking up very frequently, and also the drops in the oxygen levels, which might have health effects as well, particularly on the brain, which needs oxygen to function normally.
Well, I have to say, when we were discussing this topic yesterday and deciding to do a show on it, started asking around the newsroom, and almost everyone had a story. They knew of someone. They knew about it. They were concerned about it. And we said, this is really important. People need to know about this. So what did your study find?
Well, our study found, first of all, it is a very common condition, especially in older adults. And we found that how we define sleep apnea was having 15 or more episodes per hour of sleep where the person stops breathing and the drops in the oxygen levels. And we found 35% to be suffering from that condition. So that's a very high number. It is very common, and it's good to hear that there's more awareness of it. But what we found is in those women who came into the study—
And this is a study of all women, right?
It's older women. The average age is 82, and the majority of the women were over the age of 80. And so when at the time they entered into the study, they were free of dementia. We did overnight home-based sleep studies to detect sleep apnea. And then we brought the women back 5 years later to look at their mental function. We did tests of memory, concentration, and attention, and characterized them for a condition called mild cognitive impairment, and a more severe form is actually referred to as dementia. So we found that those women who had the moderate to severe sleep apnea initially, over the five-year period, had about a doubling of the risk of developing cognitive impairment compared to those without sleep apnea.
We're not just talking memory loss here.
No, it's really, it's a set of tests that involves memory. It also involves concentration and attention. It's an expanded, it's a battery of tests that's conducted in order to characterize these conditions.
Let's go to Dr. Kushida now, who is the medical director of the Stanford Sleep Medical Center. Dr. Kushida, you see patients daily. Were you surprised with these findings?
Yes. In the context of elderly women are not a population that's been intensely studied in the past, and it just raises awareness that that population should also be looked at, and that population might also be more vulnerable to the effects of sleep apnea in terms of their cognitive performance. So yes, in that particular area, I was surprised by the results.
You see patients daily, and men and women. When you see them, what are you looking for, and what do you find on a daily basis?
Yes, on a daily basis, about 70% of our population that comes through our center has some degree of sleep disordered breathing, and these are people that, as Dr. So mentioned, they have things like fragmentation of their sleep, their oxygen drops down to dangerous levels, and in addition, they might have severe snoring, which impacts the quality of life of their bed partners. So these type of symptoms and signs are the type of things that we typically see on a daily basis here.
And talk about men versus women. This study dealt mainly with women exclusively, but I always thought that it might be men that had sleep apnea more. Is it because they snore more, or women don't snore? That's what my mother always said.
Well, that's absolutely right. Before the age of menopause, what happens is that there is a increased risk of sleep apnea in men versus women. It's up to 8 times that amount of women. But after menopause, the rates or the prevalence of sleep apnea tend to equalize. So it definitely is in terms of middle age, more frequent in men than women.
You have been studying this for 30 plus years. How common is this diagnosis?
Well, depending on what studies you look at, it's estimated that about somewhere in the range of 18 million or higher is a prevalence in the United States of sleep apnea. And generally, if you look at the numbers, and a lot of this is based on some very pivotal early studies where it's about 4% of men, 2% of women between the ages of 30 and 60 have some degree of daytime sleepiness associated with sleep study evidence of having sleep apnea.
When you look at the symptoms, though, a lot of us wake up and we're tired and we're yawning. How do you know the difference between just having a late night and that you actually have a medical disorder?
Well, there's two things that can really influence your alertness during the daytime, and that's the quality of your sleep and the quantity of your sleep. The quantity is something you have control over. So if you're able to get a pretty good a night of sleep, meaning like about 8 hours or more, and you still feel sleepy despite having, adequate time to sleep, that indicates that you might have a problem with the quality of your sleep, such as a disorder like sleep apnea that's fragmenting your sleep and causing you to be sleepy during the daytime.
Let's go ahead and bring in our other guest, Edward Grandy, Executive Director of the Sleep Apnea Association of America. And Edward, is this a lobbying organization?
But we're actually, the American Sleep Apnea Association is a nonprofit patient interest organization. So we perform an educational task, educational function through educational materials that we have on our website and that we distribute. We also sponsor a network of support groups around the country. One of those great support groups is actually at the University of California, San Francisco, Mount Zion Hospital, and I send a shout out to Kim Trotter. We do advocacy, and in terms of trying to influence educate legislators and federal agencies around the importance of sleep apnea as a medical condition that's A, common, B, serious, and C, easily treated.
I know Dr. Kishida mentioned something about 18 million Americans perhaps suffer from that. Do you think that's an accurate number?
Dr. Kishida mentioned, that at some level or another, it's difficult to get a handle on exactly how many people it is. because it depends on where you start counting the number of apneas. In the study that's been referred to, they were talking about people having an apnea hypopnea index of 15 or greater, which is to say that they would have 15 or more events during each hour that they're asleep. So it's, I think, as a benchmark, 18 million is a number that a lot of people are comfortable with, but it's probably likely that it's a much larger number, and that would include people who have milder forms of the condition, like upper airway resistance syndrome, as well as a more severe form. Because, you know, understand that you could have apneic events totaling in the hundreds over the course of a night. So, you know, you could have very, very severe sleep apnea as well.
When you say hundreds, and we're talking about 15 an hour, hundreds, what are the costs to society? I mean, this affects, you know, everything that we do. I can't imagine that when I'm waking up and I'm taking a bus or I'm taking public transportation or I'm driving my own car that I'm not fully there all the time.
Well, you know, that I think is, again, as Dr. Kushida mentioned, it's quantity and quality of sleep. But I think that if you think about it in terms of bus drivers or train operators or long-haul truckers, these are populations that are particularly susceptible to having sleep apnea. And the consequences of them not getting their sleep apnea appropriately treated can be pretty severe in terms of automobile accidents or industrial accidents. I think one of the things that's interesting, and I think that the work that this study, and there was something that was just published by the Agency for Research and Health Research and Quality about sleep apnea, is that we're raising awareness not only about this condition, but we're also putting a focus on sleep and the importance of sleep. Now, it's difficult to talk about bad sleep unless you have some idea of how important good sleep is. And clearly, as indicated by this particular study, if somebody if their sleep is fragmented or they're experiencing sleep deprivation as a result of sleep apnea, there's going to be cognitive impairments. So good sleep means thinking clearly. Bad sleep means not thinking clearly. And it's that not thinking clearly that comes from bad sleep that we really need to be worried about. And sleep apnea is very likely a cause of that bad sleep in a lot of people.
We are discussing sleep apnea. Our guests are Dr. Clee Kushida, sleep specialist at Stanford University, Edward Grandy of the American Sleep Apnea Association, and epidemiologist Katie Stone from the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute. Dr. Kushida, I want to go back with you. Can you give us, when your patients come in, what kind of symptoms are they complaining about?
Yeah, the primary symptoms are daytime sleepiness. So what that means is inadvertent episodes of waves of sleepiness that occur throughout the day. They also frequently have snoring that's loud and disruptive. And on top of that, they might also have witnessed breathing pauses. So their bed partner notices that they have pauses in their breathing that are frequently concluded by a snort, a gasp, or a sigh. Those are the most common symptoms. Secondary symptoms are things like headaches in the morning, also night sweats, you know, waking up and noticing that your bedclothes are damp. These are some of the more common symptoms that are associated with sleep apnea.
And, Katie, when you had your study, we were conducting your study, did you find other symptoms that these women had?
Well, we were looking at sleepiness, of course, and this is an observational study, and the participants were all in Minnesota and the Pittsburgh area. So we weren't here in San Francisco, we weren't directly observing them. But I think what Dr. Kushida, the symptoms that he mentioned, those are fairly standard symptoms that you would see.
And Dr. Kushida, when you get these, you realize what they are dealing with, their symptoms and their complaints. What kind of treatments are out there?
The mainstay of treatments are continuous positive airway pressure. Basically, a machine that gently blows air via mask that fits over the nose. The air goes into the nose and down the airway and keeps the airway from collapsing at night. That's by far the most common treatment. There's also upper airway surgery, which removes some of the excess tissue in the back of the airway. Also might have some surgeries on the jaw that displace the jaw forward and also open up the airway. There's also oral appliances that are dental devices that are like retainers that fit into the mouth, and they typically either move the jaw or the tongue forward. Those are the three most common forms of treatment.
Is there one that is more effective than the other, or do they work, or do people feel like that they get some sort of relief?
Yes, CPAP is considered the primary treatment. Surgery is also indicated for patients that do have sleep apnea, particularly those that you know, might not want to wear the device for the rest of their life. Also, you know, younger patients tend to prefer going with the surgical route. Oral appliances are considered more secondary treatment. Patients that you know, don't want to wear either the CPAP device, don't want to have surgery, and the oral appliances are mainly indicated for people that have mild to moderate cases of sleep apnea, which means that they have sleep apnea severity levels that range from about 5 abnormal breathing events per hour of sleep.
But what exactly is an oral appliance?
An oral appliance is it's just like a mouth guard or retainer that just fits in the mouth and just moves the tongue or lower jaw forward.
Okay. Why do you think more people don't get treated? Is because they're not diagnosed? Or I know some personally that you try to tell them to go to the doctor and they don't feel like that it's that big of an issue. Men especially. Well, men never.
Yeah, I think you're sort of highlighting it a little earlier when you're saying that, you know, people might feel drowsy occasionally during the daytime and, you know, might not take it seriously, or, they might have snoring that's, you know, loud, and, you know, they might think, well, it's just a nuisance, but it's nothing really serious. So I think there's a general tendency to sort of feel that, well, you know, it's not a serious condition, but you know, it is. It can have serious repercussions on the cardiovascular system in particular. And there's been studies that have shown that, you know, people in the age range of about 40 to 70 who have severe cases, they can be up to 70% more likely to develop coronary heart disease compared to those without apnea. So there's emerging evidence to indicate that it does have effects on the heart.
And of course, Katie, as this study, your study has shown, there is a link between the sleep apnea and dementia. How solid do you believe this link is?
Well, I feel fairly confident that, you know, the study is finding a real association. From this kind of a study, you can't say 100% that it's a causal association because it is observational. So I think there are maybe studies being done, and maybe Dr. Kushida can speak to some of this research, but where maybe older adults with sleep apnea are treated to see if we can actually slow the decline in cognitive function over time. I think those are the types of studies that we need to take this one step further. So our study was very important because it showed that in people free of dementia, you know, those with sleep apnea have a higher risk to develop this condition, these cognitive problems over time, whereas previous studies had been more a single snapshot in time to say that, you know, people with sleep apnea seem to have more cognitive problems, but, the, you know, measuring both of those things at the same time. So this study, you know, looks into the future in people free of that condition, and we see an increased risk. And it's a fairly substantial association. I mean, it's nearly a doubling of risk in these individuals. And there's certainly research from animal studies suggesting that hypoxia or low oxygen levels in particular may have a negative impact on brain function. So, you know, I think we're really getting there in terms of saying that this is real.
And of course, when we're talking about this study with older women, we talk with Edward Grandy about the widespread prevalence of it in the United States. We've been talking about adults, but Dr. Kushida, I mean, there are a lot of younger people and even children who have this disorder.
Absolutely. In children, it's estimated to be about 3% of the population, you know, that has sleep apnea. And with children, it can manifest differently from adults in terms of they might not have more overt sleepiness, but instead, you know, might have symptoms that might mimic attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, meaning that behaviorally, you know, they might be more irritable, they might be hyperactive, they might have mood changes, distractibility, you know, these type of symptoms. And on top of that, with children, they're especially vulnerable because most of the growth hormone is secreted in the first third of the night. So with sleep apnea, which can fragment the sleep, you know, it can have impacts on their growth as well.
Edward, I want to ask you, as you look at sort of the big picture from Washington, D.C., do you think the federal government and the health organizations are aware of how severe this is?
Certainly, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal agency that oversees Medicare, is, and they're paying a lot more attention to it. It's a significant expense to them, both from a testing standpoint and from a treatment standpoint. So there's work. There's definitely work that's going on there. Federal agencies that are involved in transportation, the Department of Transportation, and agencies within that department that regulate trucking, railroads, aviation, they are also acutely aware of how serious untreated sleep apnea is in terms of causing accidents. So there's a focus there. We're doing our bit to help make sure that as healthcare evolves in the United States, that sleep apnea diagnosis and treatment continues to be on the front burner as opposed to being moved to the back burner, precisely because it's very common and it's a very serious condition that can have consequences not only in terms of cognitively, but we've also described it as far as having cardiovascular consequences. There are also metabolic consequences in terms of increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Also, depression. There are a lot of women who are diagnosed as being depressed when, in fact, they're not getting quality sleep because of untreated sleep apnea. So sleep apnea is one of these conditions that I describe it as being a gateway to other problems because it keeps people from being able to get a good night's sleep. And we're doing what we can to make sure that the federal government, the agencies that are responsible for healthcare and regulating trucking and these transportation agencies are aware of how serious it is and working to be a resource to them as far as getting educational materials to the people that need to have them.
We're going to continue our conversation about sleep apnea after a short break, and we want to hear from you. Do you or a family member suffer from the disorder? If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that number is 866-733-6786. And you can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Sydney Kohara, sitting in for Michael Krasny today. You're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Sydney Kohara, in for Michael Krasny today. A new study suggests that people who suffer from sleep apnea may also be at increased risk of developing dementia. We're talking with Katie Stone, co-author of that new study and senior scientist at the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute, Dr. Klee Kushida, neurologist and sleep specialist at Stanford University, and Edward Grandy. He's executive director of the American Sleep Apnea Association. We're going to find out what our listeners have to say, and I tell you, the calls are coming in, Katie. A lot of people are very interested in this subject.
Well, it's a very common condition, so I'm not surprised.
Do you have research and clinical trials ongoing at all times?
We don't have clinical trials ongoing at this time, but I think that's an important area. Now that we have solid evidence that there is this association, I think the next step is to take a group of older adults with sleep apnea and treat them, have a treatment group and a control group and see the effects of treatment on cognitive function over time. And I think that there have been other ongoing trials. I know that Dr. Kushida may be involved in the APPLES trial, and I think that they
Dr.
may have
Dr. Kushida,
some...
is that, can you tell us more about that one?
Yeah, the APPLES trial is an NIH-funded trial that we looked at about 1,105 subjects throughout the United States, and we also looked at neurocognitive performance. We published our baseline study earlier this year, which showed an association between neurocognitive performance with severe cases of sleep apnea. We didn't specifically look at the elderly group within that within our population, but given Dr. Stone's results, that is something that we want to definitely look at.
Edward, let me ask you, you're Executive Director of the Sleep Apnea Association of America. Can you give us an idea of the state of funding for research into sleep apnea?
Well, their NIH has a center within the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute that's devoted to sleep. It's the National Center on Sleep Disorders Research. And, most of the funding that comes out for this type of work goes through NIH. And, given the current budgetary climate, it's going to be kind of difficult. It may be difficult for them to sustain the funding levels that they have had in the past. The Senator Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania was a great champion of the NIH, and as a senior member of the Senate was very strong in being able to help either increase funding or make sure that funding was preserved. We're certainly trying to encourage members of Congress to continue to support funding for NIH and specifically funding for the work of the National Center on Sleep Disorders Research.
Well, judging by the number of calls and emails, we're getting a lot of people very interested. Let's go ahead and go to our first call. And this is from Kevin in Manchester, New Hampshire. Kevin, you're on with Forum.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because I have sleep apnea. If I had been left to my own devices, I would have never diagnosed myself or even thought that there was a problem. My wife is the one who noticed the symptoms and noted that my father has sleep apnea, which we had talked about. I didn't know that I was doing the stopping breathing. I knew that I snored. But once I was diagnosed and sought and received treatment, I can't believe how good I feel. I had no idea how tired I really was. There was nothing for me to compare it to. I didn't know what normal was.
Dr. Kushida, is that the case? That's what most of your patients, if they get some sort of treatment?
Yeah, a lot of times what happens is, the patients will have a gradual decrease in their alertness over time. So, they might not be aware of it on a day-to-day basis, but then suddenly when they have treatment for apnea, suddenly they become, more alert. They feel a lot more rested, and a lot of times, their mood improves as well.
But sometimes treatment doesn't always work. Let's go to Leslie now, who is I think we just lost Leslie. I think that was my fault. I apologize, Leslie, and we'll see if we can get you back. Let's go to Lisa in Oakland. Lisa, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Yeah, my situation is I have had sleep apnea, and I have tried all of the treatments. I have tried the operation, the dental, and the CPAP machine. And the problem is, as perhaps you know, the CPAP machine, especially for people who have insomnia as well as sleep apnea, is very hard to adjust to. I think up to 20% of people who try the CPAP machine are not able to adjust to it. And so I do find that there's a big hole in this approach where there's not enough combining of working with people who actually have insomnia as well as sleep apnea. I know the Stanford Sleep Clinic is one of the few places that actually combines some sleep hygiene treatment, but it doesn't even deal with aspects of, for instance, people who are depressed who may need medication in order to help sleep. So I think that I'm feeling like there's a big population out there that's not getting help, that isn't being addressed, and I would like if you could talk to that population.
Dr. Kishida, when we, Lisa is talking about this, and why don't you quickly describe the CPAP machine? I think a lot of people don't realize that it's a pretty invasive machine.
Yes. Well, the CPAP machine is basically a mask that fits over the nose, sometimes the nose and the mouth, and it has a hose that's connected to a machine, basically an air pump that pulls in air from the outside and gently pushes it into the nose and down the throat to keep the airway open. And as a listener mentioned, these treatments right now are the best we have, and there are patients that just can't tolerate the CPAP for a variety of reasons, and there are other treatment options. What we find out is that within the first few weeks of treatment, that's where the working with a patient to try and overcome some of the difficulties with CPAP is critically important. But if the person has apnea plus insomnia, that raises a lot of different challenges.
We have another caller, Leslie from Bay Village, who is also, I believe, having a few problems. Leslie, go ahead with your question.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My ex-husband suffered from sleep apnea before we even knew that it was called sleep apnea, and this would have been about 15 years ago when we were newlyweds, and it was absolutely terrifying because I would hear a click, he would stop breathing and wake up gasping, and of course the snoring and what that does to a marriage is difficult as well. He went to see a sleep center to be tested, and the testing process itself was so grueling, he said, I couldn't even get to a deep sleep. And he called me and couldn't even speak clearly because he had so many nodes on his face. So he's continued, obviously we're no longer married, but I know this is still an issue for him. And he's continued to suffer with it because he's like, I'm not going to go back and be tested like that again. And I know what the treatments might be, and I can't live that way. So I would rather get less sleep, have the snoring problem, and now I know how to deal with it when I stop breathing, how to get myself back on track. So I'm going to live with it. And I obviously, we're divorced, but I find that sad for him.
So is there a way, Dr. Kishida and Katie, if you want to jump in, are there other methods where people sort of lifestyle differences or changes that people can make that might help?
Well, Dr. Stone showed in her study, there's other ways of diagnosing sleep apnea other than bringing the patient in for a lab test. In Dr. Stone's study, which is becoming more common, are the in-home studies where patients can be hooked up to a portable device that they take home, and that can be used to help in the diagnosis of sleep apnea. With respect to your question, behavioral treatments, there really isn't a lot of behavioral treatments that have been shown to be, that effective, for the treatment of apnea, aside from adjunctive treatments like weight loss control and also body positioning, meaning to try to have the patient try to sleep on their sides, which might, reduce the frequency of the apnea. But that approach isn't really that successful.
We have another call now from Manish in Sunnyvale, and I think he wants to talk about this lifestyle approach as well. Manish, you're on the air. Manish,
hello, good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I have this suggestion, and I felt why do we use so much of invasive procedures or machines to get rid of the problem or to reduce the problem? I feel that lifestyle changes or using yoga therapies could also be very much helpful in bringing a balance in life and getting rid of the disorder or reducing it.
Dr. Kishida, does that help?
Just to clarify, the sleep apnea is believed to be, it is known to be a mechanical problem, meaning that the airway, collapses during sleep. And there have been studies that, to evaluate whether increasing the muscle tone or strengthening the tone of the muscles in the upper airway can help with sleep apnea. And in some cases, for very mild cases, that can be true. But in the majority of cases, where the person has, moderate to severe cases, that's where, the more conventional treatments have been shown to be most effective.
We will continue our conversation about sleep apnea. Our guests are Dr. Clete Kushida, sleep specialist at Stanford University, Edward Grandy of the American Sleep Apnea Association, and epidemiologist Katie Stone from the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute. A lot of phone calls, a lot of emails. I want to go ahead and read one of the emails we got in. My cousin, this is from Ashley in Mountain View. My cousin went in for a Galileo scan because of unexplained pain. Not only did the specialist diagnose her with a perforated sinus, which explained her pain, but also said it looked as if she had sleep apnea and should get that properly taken care of. So should people with daytime sleepiness like my cousin get a scan?
I think in terms of scanning, there are more, effective and standardized way of diagnosing sleep apnea, and that would be, by either a in-lab study or an at-home, study in which electrodes are placed on the face and body to measure sleep, but also measure the breathing during the sleep. So there's more standardized methods of diagnosing sleep apnea other than getting scanned.
That's a where do you start, Katie? And, when we were talking about your study with the 300 women, mm-hmm. how did you find them? Did they first go to their medical practitioner?
No, these were women who actually –
knew that they had a problem?
No, they didn't even suspect, most of them, that they had a problem. These were community-dwelling women who had volunteered to participate in a larger study called the Study of Osteoporotic Fractures. It was an osteoporosis cohort study that had been ongoing for some time. And so subsequently, at a later exam, actually the eighth time we brought them in, we decided to look at their sleep and see what some of the downstream outcomes that are related to poor sleep in these older women would be. So these were women who were, it was more of a representative cohort of volunteers from the community. And we didn't know at the time whether they would have sleep apnea or not. So they didn't come in seeking treatment for their sleep problems.
When you look at the people who were in your study, do you think it could have been a much larger study, considering the problem out there?
It could have been. We would always like it to be a much larger study, but, to do polysomnography, the overnight sleep studies in a large number of people is very expensive, and, the funding is these days difficult to come by through the National Institutes of Health, so... we were happy. This is actually for this type of a study. It's considered fairly large. We have a men's study, which is ongoing, and we have 3,000 men in that study that we've performed overnight home sleep studies in. And so we'd like to look at this question also in that group of older men.
Edward, I'd like to ask you, when you look at the prevalence of this around the country, and we talk about cost, is this adequately covered by insurance when people want or need help?
Well, unfortunately, it's a mixed bag. Given that there are different insurance companies and different insurance plans, there are some plans like Kaiser Permanente out there in California, who has a very well-developed program for diagnosing and treating sleep apnea. There are other insurance companies that will pay for the test but won't pay for the machine, or they'll pay for the machine but they won't pay for the test. Unfortunately, there isn't consistency in terms of how this condition is being both diagnosed and being treated. And ultimately, it's not so much just giving somebody a CPAP machine, but it's actually helping them learn how to use it and following up so that they are answering questions and dealing with problems that they might have. Our hope is that as healthcare evolves here in the United States based on the Affordable Care Act, that we may be able to help create models for the delivery of services, both diagnostic and therapeutic, for people that could be adopted by other insurance companies around the country. I might add that there are a lot of insurance companies now that are moving in the direction of not having people come into the sleep lab for an overnight polysomnography, but are actually recommending or requiring patients to have an in-home study and only having an in-lab study if it's deemed medically necessary.
And again, Dr. Kushida actually mentioned that people do have tests that they can take home. Yeah. Let's go to our next caller. This is Wendy in Hercules. Hi, Wendy. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 67-year-old professional. Clean driving record, went undiagnosed with sleep apnea. Ended up falling asleep at the wheel, totaled 4 cars, luckily mine and 3 parked cars. I was handcuffed, taken. I had my blood drawn because they charged me with DUI under the influence, which came out negative, by the way. Held in the drunk tank for 18 hours. And they have, the DA has a year to file charges. So basically, it's impaired all of my relationships at work with my family. I can't drive my grandson. I am being treated with CPAP now with slight improvement and the need for a sleep aid as well. I just want people to know how serious it is. I had fatigue symptoms for a long time. I've been treated for depression for 30 years, so that wasn't caught. It's serious.
If I can jump in, you know, this is clearly, this is an example where the lack of understanding in the primary care community has let her basically fall through the cracks and really risk her life and the lives of other people unnecessarily. There's still a bit of a learning curve here that's necessary among primary care physicians to help them recognize that somebody may have a problem with their sleep and then make them a referral to physicians like Dr. Kushida for further testing and examination.
Our next call sort of addresses that same thing, that there are organizations, even medical practitioners, who are really not aware of the consequences of this. Let's go to our next call. This is Fred in Oakland. Fred, welcome to Forum.
Not Fred, it's Chris.
I'm sorry, Chris.
Yep. I am a 64-year-old obese, diabetic, hypertensive male, and I'm fairly sure I have sleep apnea. I fall asleep during the day all the time, et cetera, et cetera. And I can't get my doctor to do anything about it. He's a fairly young guy, so he should know about this stuff. But I keep asking to be referred somewhere, and he keeps not doing it.
Dr. Kushida?
It's time. Yeah. In that particular case, you know, what I would recommend it are, you know, it depends on your insurance plans, but some insurance plans allow you to you know, be able to go to a sleep center directly. If it is a case where your insurance plan doesn't allow you to you know, go to a center without a referral, my advice would be to, you know, have your doctor look at some of the websites, you know, that do explain about the seriousness of sleep apnea, for instance, like sleepeducation.com, which is by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, or if that doesn't work, you know, what I would maybe even suggest would be to maybe get a second opinion from another primary care physician, because it's clear that your current physician is not appreciating the severity of your condition. And based on what was reported on the last caller, you know, it can have serious consequences.
Edward, I think you wanted to jump in as well.
In addition to, you know, certainly the American Sleep Apnea Association's website is very useful, sleepapnea.org. I mentioned earlier that the Agency for Health Research and Quality has just published the results of a comparative effectiveness review. And if you go to the association's websites, sleepapnea.org, you can find links to both the clinician's guide and a consumer's guide. And I would strongly recommend that the caller print out a copy of the clinician guide and hand carry it to him. But I would also suggest that he needs to think about finding another doctor, young doctor or no doctor. Clearly, this gentleman, obese, he's in the age range, he has hypertension, he has diabetes. I mean, it's not three strikes, it's four strikes. This guy really needs help.
Thank you very much for your call. We've got an email that came in, I think, that is about the same thing. Another medical practitioner who maybe isn't up to speed with the latest information, but this comes from Keith. I have been diagnosed with moderate to severe sleep apnea. I recently had a severe attack, woke up without being able to breathe. My doctor recommended I go to the emergency room at Alta Bates Hospital. I did, and after checking my vitals, a doctor came in and we talked about the episode and sleep apnea in general, and she said, you can't die from sleep apnea. Well, my research on the internet disagrees, and several sources seem to say that you can die from it. So my question is, can you die from sleep apnea or not?
Wow. Well, I mean, I think there are studies that Dr. Kishida mentioned earlier showing an increased risk of cardiovascular events in people with sleep apnea. And, you know, there's definitely evidence to suggest that over time, if this condition persists, you know, potentially you could die from this condition. We can't, you know, say in an individual case whether that will happen. But, you know, we know that it's not healthy for you. And, you know, if it persists over time, it's definitely not good for your health.
Dr. Kishida?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been studies that have shown, you know, the risk with sleep apnea and cardiovascular disease, but also, you know, ones that have actually looked at survival regarding sleep disordered breathing and mortality. And they have shown an increased risk for those that do have sleep apnea. So there definitely is an association between sleep disordered breathing and mortality.
Yeah, can I also suggest that there was a study that was done out of the Mayo Clinic looking at sudden cardiac death, and it was determined that people who have sleep apnea, untreated sleep apnea, are more likely to die between midnight and 6 o'clock in the morning than people who don't have sleep apnea, who would tend to die between 6 in the morning and noon. This was done based on reviewing death records in Minnesota. So there's clearly, you know, it's not the sleep apnea that kills you, but it's the damage to your heart that does.
And let's, we have time for one last call. This is from Chris in Oakland, and I think this is going to bring it back around to our study results. Chris, welcome to Forum. Hi, Chris.
I'm Chris, and I already talked to you.
Okay, all right. I thought so. So let's see, Neil in Richmond. Neil?
Yes. Hi. I was actually I experienced tonsillitis when I was 24 years old and flared my tonsils, and years later was the contributor to me being diagnosed with sleep apnea. And my ENT recommended a tonsillectomy, as well as I had an elongated uvula, so he recommended that uvula be removed and the palate trimmed. I was curious about two things. One is, is that surgery for the uvula being removed and palate trim still recommended today? And also, in terms of the impact of cognitive abilities and cardiovascular impact, how long have you guys typically seen in patients? When does that occur? And are there ways to self-diagnose cognitive issues? And how can that be repaired potentially?
Dr. Kishida?
Yeah, in reference to your first question, yes, the surgeries to the soft palate, like a uvulopalatopharyngoplasty, you know, where they cut out some of the excess tissue at the soft palate and the uvula, are still being done. What I
would recommend is, you know, particularly if you've been diagnosed with sleep apnea, to go back to your ENT and to discuss, you know, for your particular case, what would be the expected, you know, cure rate. Secondly, regarding the, you know, how much of an impact, you know, your disorder has on your neurocognitive function. Standardized, you know, tests that you could take. But what I would really recommend would be to go back to your physician, go back to your, possibly a sleep specialist and discuss it with them, because then they can give you those tests in a more, standardized fashion rather than, downloading something from the internet.
Okay, and I was just going to add that we really don't have the information to say, you know, the long-term effects of having sleep apnea at a young age and how that will play out much later on in life. Again, those studies are expensive, and we'd like to do them, but, you know, that's an area where we don't have complete information, unfortunately.
But again, this is a start, and perhaps more clinical trials and more studies in the future.
Right. I think there's definitely room for more research in this area.
For young and old alike. And that was Katie Stone, co-author of the new study and a senior scientist at the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute. We were also joined today by Dr. Khalid Kushida, neurologist and sleep specialist at Stanford University, and Edward Grandy, executive director of the American Sleep Apnea Association. Thank you all very much for being a part of our program. I'm Sydney Kohara, in for Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.